about me. Your mother and this lady made quite a scene in your mother's yard. Bing told me all about it. You will be surprised to know that Bing saw the whole thing from the house across the street. Wayne frowned, wondered how Bing had been able to watch from across the street. The Desotes lived over there. An answer suggested itself. It wasn't funny in the slightest. They reached the door under the stairs. Max turned the knob and opened it to reveal a little half-bathroom under a slanted roof. Max reached for a chain hanging from a bare light bulb and pulled it, but the room remained dark.
Bing is letting this place go to the dogs. I will leave the door open to allow you a little light.
He nudged Wayne into the dim bathroom. The door remained ajar about half a foot, but the old man stepped aside to give Wayne his privacy.
How does your mother happen to know this peculiar lady, and why would they be talking about me?
I don't know. I never saw her before.
You read the news stories she brought, though. Stories about me, most of them. I would like to tell you, the news reports about my case are full of the most outrageous libels. I have never killed a single child, not one, and I am no kitty fiddler either. The fires of hell are not hot enough for such people. Your mother's visitor did not seem to think I was dead. That is a remarkable notion to have, considering that the papers widely reported upon not only my demise, but also my autopsy. Why do you think she had so much faith in my continued survival?
I don't know that either. Wayne stood there holding his prick, unable to pee. My mother said she was a crazy person.
You are not having me on, are you, Wayne?
No, sir.
What did this woman with the curious hair say about me?
My mother sent me inside the house. I didn't hear any of it.
Oh, you are telling me a tall one now, Bruce Wayne Carmody.
But he didn't say it like he was angry about it.
Are you having difficulties with your fiddlestick?
My what?
Your winky. Your pee-pee?
Oh, maybe a little.
It is because we are talking. It is never easy to tinkle when someone is listening to you. I will move 3 steps away.
Wayne heard Manx's heels rapping on the concrete as he moved off. Almost immediately, Wayne's bladder let go and the urine rained down. As he peed, he let out a long sigh of relief and tipped back his head. There was a poster above the toilet. It showed a naked woman on her knees with her hands tied behind her. Her head was stuffed into a gas mask. A man in a Nazi uniform stood over her, holding a leash, the collar around her neck. Wayne shut his eyes, pushed his fiddlestick, no, penis, fiddlestick was a grotesque word, back into his shorts and turned away. He washed his hands in a sink with a cockroach clinging to the side. As he did, he was relieved to discover he had not found anything funny about that awful poster. It's the car. It's being in the car that makes everything seem funny, even when it's awful. As soon as he had this thought, he knew it was true. He stepped out of the bathroom, and Manx was there, holding the door open to the back seat of the Wraith. In his other hand was the silver mallet. He grinned to show his stained teeth. Wayne thought he might be able to run as far as the driveway before Manx smashed his head in.
"Tell you what," Max said. "I would really like to know more about your mother's confidant. I am sure if you put your mind to it, you will remember some details you have forgotten. Why don't you sit in the car and turn it over in your mind? I will go and get your breakfast. By the time I come back, perhaps something will have occurred to you. What do you say to that?"
Wayne shrugged, but his heart surged at the thought of being alone in the car.
The phone...
He only needed a minute alone to call his father and tell him everything. Sugar Creek, Pennsylvania. Pink House. Right down the hill from a burned church. The cops would be here before Manx got back with his bacon and eggs. He climbed into the car willingly, without hesitation. Manx shut the door and knocked on the glass.
"I will be back in a jiffy. Don't run away."
And he laughed as the lock banged down. Wayne knelt on the seat to watch through the rear window as Manx left. When the old man had disappeared into the back of the house, Wayne turned, dropped to the floor, grabbed the walnut drawer beneath the driver's seat, and yanked it open to get his phone. Gone. Bing's garage. Somewhere a dog barked and a lawnmower started and the world went on, but here in the Rolls-Royce the world had caught in place because the phone was gone. Wayne pulled the drawer all the way out and put his hand in it, patting down the bay's interior, as if the phone might be hiding under the drawer lining somehow. He knew he was not mistaken, and that this was the drawer he had put it in, but he closed it and looked in the other drawer beneath the passenger seat. It was just as empty. "Where are you?" Wayne cried, although he already knew. While he had been washing his hands, Manx had climbed into the back seat and collected the phone himself. He was probably walking around with it in the pocket of his greatcoat right this instant. Wayne felt like crying. He had built a delicate cathedral of hope deep inside him, and Manx had stepped on it, then lit it on fire. God burned alive, only devils now. It was stupid, pointless, but Wayne went back and opened the first drawer again for another look. There were Christmas ornaments in it. They had not been there a moment ago. A moment before, the drawer had been absolutely empty. Now, though, the drawer contained an enamel angel with tragic, drooping eyes, a great silver snowflake dusted in glitter, and a sleeping blue moon in a Santa Claus cap. "What is this?" Wayne said, hardly aware he was speaking aloud. He lifted each out in turn. The angel hung from a golden loop, turning gently, blowing her horn. The snowflake looked deadly, a weapon, a ninja's throwing star. The moon smiled at his own private musings. Wayne returned the ornaments to the drawer where he had discovered them and gently pushed the drawer shut. Then opened it again. Empty once more. He exhaled a frustrated, fuming breath and slammed the drawer, whispering furiously, "I want my phone back!" Something clicked in the front seat. Wayne looked up in time to see the glove compartment fall open. His phone sat on a stack of road maps. Wayne stood in the back seat. He had to hunch, with the back of his head pressed to the ceiling, but it could be done. He felt as if he had just seen a bit of sleight of hand. A magician had passed a palm over a bouquet of flowers and transformed them into his iPhone. Mingled with his sense of surprise, astonishment even, was an ill tickle of dismay. The Wraith was teasing him. The Wraith, or Manx, Wayne had a notion that they were the same thing, that the one was an extension of the other. The Wraith was a part of Manx like Wayne's right hand was a part of him. Wayne stared at his phone, already knowing he had to try to get it, already knowing that the car had some way of keeping it from him. But never mind the phone. The driver's side door was unlocked, nothing stopping him from getting out of the car and making a run for it. Nothing except that the last three times he had tried to climb into the front seat, he had somehow wound up in the back again. He had been drugged then, though. The gas mask man had sprayed him with gingerbread smoke, and it had blurred his thoughts. He could hardly pick himself up off the floor. No wonder he kept falling into the back seat. The real wonder was that he had hung on to consciousness as long as he had. Wayne lifted his right hand, preparing to reach across the divider, and noticed at that moment that he was still holding the Christmas ornament in the shape of the moon. He had, in fact, been rubbing his thumb along its smooth, sickle-shaped curve for a full minute now, a thoughtless gesture that he found curiously soothing. He blinked at it, briefly befuddled. He could have sworn he'd put all three ornaments back in their drawer. That moon, Wayne noticed now, with its plump cheeks and big nose and long eyelashes, somewhat resembled his own father. He put it in his pocket, then lifted his hand once more and reached over the divider in the direction of the glove compartment. As his fingers crossed into the front seat, they dwindled. His fingertips became fleshy nubs that ended at the first knuckle. When he saw it happening, his shoulders jumped in a nervous reflex, but he did not pull back his hand. It was grotesque, but also somehow fascinating. He could still feel the ends of his fingers. He could rub his fingertips together, feel the leathery pad of his thumb stroking the end of his index finger. He just couldn't see them. Wayne reached farther over the divider, pushed his whole hand across the invisible barrier. His arm dwindled to a smooth pink stump, a painless amputation. He opened and closed a fist he couldn't see. It was there. He could feel his hand was there. He just wasn't sure where there was. He reached a little farther, in the general direction of the glove compartment and his phone. Something poked him in the back. At the same moment, the fingers of his invisible right hand struck something solid. Wayne turned his head to look behind him. An arm, his arm, stretched out of the seat behind him. It didn't look as if it had torn through the seat, but as if it had grown from it. The hand at the end of the arm was skin. So was the wrist. But close to the seat, the flesh darkened and roughened and became worn old beige leather, stretching out from the seat itself, putting visible strain on the fabric around it. The natural thing to do would have been to scream, but Wayne was all screamed out. He made a fist with his right hand. The hand growing from the back seat clenched its fingers. It made his stomach go all funny, controlling a disembodied arm that had sprouted from a seat cushion.
"You should try thumb wrestling with yourself," Mag said.
Wayne jumped, and in his alarm he pulled his right arm back. The disembodied limb protruding from the seat went away, was inhaled back into the leather, and in the next instant was attached to his shoulder again, where it belonged. Wayne clasped the hand against his chest. His heart wrapped swiftly beneath it. Manx was bent to peer in through the rear driver's side window. He grinned to show his crooked, protruding upper teeth.
"There is plenty of fun to be had in the back of this old car. You could not find more fun on four wheels."
He had a plate in one hand, scrambled eggs and bacon and toast. In the other was a glass of orange juice.
"You will be glad to know there is nothing whatsoever healthy about this meal. It is all butter and salt and cholesterol. Even the orange juice is bad for you. It is actually something called orange drink. I have never taken a vitamin in my life, though, and I have lived to a very advanced age. Happiness will do more for you than any wonder drug the apothecaries can invent."
Wayne sat down on the rear couch. Manx opened the door, leaned in, and offered him the plate and the juice. Wayne noticed he had not been provided with a fork. Manx might carry on as if they were best friends, but he was not about to provide his passenger with a stabby weapon. A simple, perfectly clear reminder that Wayne was not a pal, but a prisoner. Wayne took the plate, and then Manx climbed into the back seat to sit beside him. Manx had said that hell was not too hot for the sort of men who fiddled with children, but Wayne readied himself, expected to be touched now. Manx would reach between Wayne's legs, ask him if he ever played with his fiddlestick. When Manx made his move, Wayne was ready to fight and lose and be molested. He would throw his breakfast at the guy. He would bite. It wouldn't matter. If Manx wanted to pull Wayne's pants down and do whatever, he would do it. He was bigger. It was that simple. Wayne would do his best to live through it. He would pretend his body belonged to someone else, and would think about the avalanche he had seen with his father. He would imagine being buried in snow with a kind of quiet relief. Someday he would be buried somewhere. Sooner rather than later, he thought. And it wouldn't matter anymore what Max had done to him. He just hoped his mother never found out. She was so unhappy already, had fought so hard not to be crazy, not to be drunk. He couldn't stand to imagine he would be the source of any more pain for her. But Manx didn't touch him. He sighed and stretched out his legs.
"I see you have already picked an ornament to hang up when we arrive at Christmasland," Manx said, "to mark your passage into that world."
Wayne glanced at his right hand and was surprised to see he was holding that sleepy moon again, running his thumb over the curve of it. He had no memory of taking it from his pocket.
"My daughters brought little angels to mark the end of their journey," Manx said in a distant, musing voice. "Take care of it, Wayne. Guard it as if it were your own life."
He clapped Wayne on the back and nodded toward the front of the car. Wayne followed his gaze and saw that he was looking at the open glove compartment, at the phone.
"Did you really think you were going to hide something from me?" Manx asked. "Here, in this car."
It didn't seem like the kind of question that required an answer. Manx crossed his arms tightly over his chest, almost as if giving himself a hug. He was smiling to himself. He didn't look angry at all.
Hiding something in this car is as bad as putting it in the pocket of my coat. I am bound to notice. Not that I can blame you for trying. Any boy would try. You should eat those eggs. They will get cold.
Wayne found himself struggling not to cry. He threw his moon on the floor.
Here, here, do not be sad. I can't stand for any child to be unhappy. Would it make you feel better to talk to your mother?
Wayne blinked. A single tear splatted on a greasy piece of bacon. The thought of hearing his mother's voice set off a small explosion inside Wayne's body, a throb of need. He nodded.
Do you know what would make me feel better? If you told me about this woman who brought all the news stories to your mother. If you will scratch my back, I will scratch yours.
I don't believe you,
Wayne whispered.
You won't call her, no matter what I do.
Manx looked over the divider, into the front seat. The glove compartment snapped shut with a loud clack. It was so surprising that Wayne almost dumped his plate of eggs. The drawer beneath the front driver's seat slid open all by itself, almost without sound. The phone rested in it. Wayne stared at it, his breathing shallow, effortful.
I have not told you a lie yet, Manx said. But I understand that you would be reluctant to trust me. Here is the thing. You know I will not give you the phone if you don't tell me about your mother's visitor. I will put it on the floor of this garage and back my car over it. That will be fun. To be honest, I think cell phones were invented by the devil. Now, think if you did tell me what I want to know. One way or another, you will have learned something important. If I do not let you call your mother, you will have learned I am a big fat liar, and you will never have to trust me again about anything. But if I do let you call her, then you will know I am as good as my word.
Wayne said,
But I don't know anything about Maggie Lee that you don't know.
Well, now you have told me her name. See, the learning process has already begun.
Wayne cringed, feeling he had just committed an unforgivable betrayal.
Miss Lee said something that frightened your mother. What was it? Tell me, and I will let you call your mother right this instant.
Wayne opened his mouth, not sure what he was going to say, but Manx stopped him. He grabbed his shoulder then and gave it a gentle squeeze.
Do not go making up stories, Wayne. Our deal is off if you are not straight with me from the get-go. Twist the truth even a little, and you will regret it.
Manx reached down and plucked a piece of bacon off the plate. One of Wayne's teardrops glistened on it, a bright, oily gem. Manx bit off half and began to chew, teardrop and all.
Well?
Manx asked.
She said you were on the move, Wayne said. That you were out of jail, and that Mom had to watch out. And I guess that's what frightened my mother.
Manx frowned, chewing slowly, his jaw moving in an exaggerated way.
I didn't hear anything else, really.
How did your mother and this woman know each other?
Wayne shrugged.
Maggie Lee said she met my mother when she was a kid, but my mom said she had never met her before.
And which of them do you think was telling the truth?
Manx asked. That one caught Wayne off guard, and he was slow to reply.
My mother.
Manx swallowed his bite of bacon and beamed.
See? That was easy. Well, I am sure your mother will be glad to hear from you.
He began to lean forward to reach for the phone, then sank back into his seat.
Oh, there is one more thing. Did this Maggie Lee say anything about a bridge?
Wayne's whole body seemed to pulse in reaction to this question. A kind of tingling throb surged through him, and he thought,
Don't tell him that.
No,
he said, before he had time to think. His voice went thick and choked, as if his lie were a piece of toast that had momentarily jammed in his throat.
Manx turned a sly, sleepy smile upon him. His eyelids sank to half-mast.
He began to move, putting one foot out the open door, rising to go. At the same time, the drawer with the phone in it came to life, slamming shut with a loud bang.
I mean, yes!
Wayne cried, grabbing him by the arm. The sudden movement upset the plate in his lap, turning it over, dumping eggs and toast on the floor.
Yes, all right. She said she had to find you again. She asked if she could still use the bridge to find you.
Max paused, half in, half out of the car, Wayne's grip still on his forearm. He stared down at Wayne's hand with that look of dreamy amusement.
I thought we agreed you were going to tell the truth from the get-go.
I did. I just forgot for a moment. Please.
You forgot, all right. You forgot to tell me the truth.
I'm sorry.
Manx didn't seem upset at all. He said,
well, it was a momentary lapse. Maybe I can still allow a phone call. But I am going to ask you one more question, and I want you to think before you answer. And when you do answer, I want you to tell me the truth, so help you God. Did Maggie Lee say anything about how your mother would get to this bridge? What did she say about the bike?
She didn't say anything about the bike. No, I swear!
Because Manx had started to pull his arm free.
I don't think she knew anything about the Triumph.
Manx hesitated.
The Triumph?
Mom's motorcycle. You remember. The one she was pushing up the road. She's been fixing it for weeks. She works on it all the time, even when she should be sleeping. Is that the bike you mean?
Manx's eyes had assumed a cool, remote quality. His face softened. He bit his lower lip with his little teeth. It was an expression that made him look feeble-minded.
Huh. Your mother is trying to build a new ride, so she can do it again, so she can find me. You know, I wondered if she might be getting up to her old tricks as soon as I saw her pushing that motorcycle. And this Maggie Lee, I imagine she has a ride of her own. Or she at least knows about those who travel on the other roads. Well, I have some more questions, but I am better off putting them to Miss Lee directly.
Manx's hand slipped into the pocket of his greatcoat, drew out the photocopied news story about Nathan Demeter, and turned the sheet of paper so Wayne could look at it. Manx tapped the header on the old stationery. Here, Public Library. Here, Iowa.
And here is where to look for her, Manx said. It is a good thing it is on the way.
Wayne was breathing rapidly, as if he had just run a very long distance.
I want to call my mom.
No, Max said, and jerked his arm free. We had a deal. The truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. My ears are still stinging from that whopper you tried to slip by me. That was too bad. You will learn soon enough that it is pretty hard to pull the wool over my eyes.
No! Wayne screamed. I told you everything you wanted to know. You promised. You said I'd have one more chance.
I said maybe I would allow a phone call if you told me the truth about your mother's bike. But you didn't know anything, and anyway, I did not say I would allow this phone call today. I think we will have to wait until tomorrow. I think if you have to wait until tomorrow, you will learn a very valuable lesson. No one likes a fibber, Wayne.
He shut the door. The lock banged down.
No!
Wayne screamed again, but Manx had already turned away, was walking across the garage, weaving between the tall green gas tanks toward the stairs to the loft.
No! It's not fair!
Wayne dropped off the seat, onto the floor. He grabbed the brass handle of the drawer with his phone in it and pulled, but it didn't budge. Might as well have been nailed shut. He put one foot on the back of the divider between the front and the rear compartment and threw all his weight backward. His sweat, slippery hands came right off the handle, and he fell back into the seat.
Please!
Wayne screamed.
Please!
At the bottom of the stairs, Manx looked back at the car. There was an expression of weary tragedy on his face. His eyes were damp with sympathy. He shook his head, although whether in refusal or simply as a gesture of disappointment, it was impossible to tell. He pressed a button on the wall. The automatic garage door rumbled down. He flipped a switch and turned out the lights before going upstairs and left Wayne alone in the Wraith. The Lake. By the time Hutter was done with her that afternoon, Vic felt wrung out, as if she were recovering from a bout of stomach flu. Her joints were sore, and her back throbbed.
She was desperately hungry, but when presented with a turkey sandwich, was almost overcome with an urge to vomit. She couldn't even choke down a whole piece of toast. She told Hutter all the old lies about Manx, how he had injected her with something and put her in his car, how she had escaped him in Colorado at the sleigh house. They sat in the kitchen, Hutter asking the questions and Vic answering them as best she could, while cops came in and out. After Vic had told the story of her kidnapping, Hutter wanted to hear about the years after. She wanted to know about the derangement that had led Vic to spend time in a mental hospital. She wanted to know about the time Vic burned her own house down. "I didn't mean to burn the house down," Vic said. "I was just trying to get rid of the phones. I stuck them all in the oven. It seemed like the simplest way to stop the phone calls."
"The phone calls from dead people?"
"From dead kids, yes."
"Is that the predominant theme of your delusions? Does it always revolve around dead children?"
"Did. Was. Past tense," Vic said. Hutter stared at Vic with all the affection of a snake handler approaching a venomous cobra. Vic thought, "Just ask me already. Ask me if I killed my little boy. Get it out in the open." She met Hutter's gaze without blinking or flinching. Vic had been hammered, shot at, nearly run over, institutionalized, addicted, had come close to being burned alive, and had run for her life on several occasions. An unfriendly stare was nothing. Hutter said,
"You might want to rest and freshen up. I've scheduled your statement for 5:20. That should get us the maximum primetime coverage."
Vic said, "I wish I thought there was something I knew, something I could tell you that would help you find him."
"You've been very helpful," Hutter said. "Thank you. I have a lot of good information here."
Hutter looked away, and Vic imagined that the interview was over. But as she rose to go, Hutter reached for something leaning against the wall, some sheets of Bristol board.
"Vic," Hutter said, "there is one other thing."
Vic stood still, a hand on the back of her chair. Hutter put the stack of Bristol board on the table, turned so Vic could look at the illustrations. Her illustrations. The pages from the new book, Search Engine's Fifth Gear, The Holiday Story. What she had been working on when she wasn't assembling the Triumph. Hutter began to shuffle the big cardstock pages, giving Vic a moment to take in each picture, rendered in non-photographic blue pencil, inked, then finished in watercolors. The paper rasped in a way that made Vic think of a fortune teller shuffling a tarot deck, preparing to deal a very bad outlook. Hutter said,
"I told you, they use the search engine puzzles at Quantico to teach students about careful observation. When I saw that you had part of a new book out in the carriage house, I couldn't help myself. I'm stunned by what you've got on the page here. You really do give Escher a run for his money. Then I looked close and started wondering, this is for a Christmas book, isn't it?" The urge to get away from the pile of Bristol board, to shrink from her own drawings as if they were photographs of skinned animals, surged inside her and then was smothered in a moment. She wanted to say she had never seen any of these pictures before, wanted to scream she didn't know where they had come from. Both of these statements would have been fundamentally true, but she clamped down on them, and when she spoke, her voice was weary and disinterested.
"Yeah, my publisher's idea."
"Well," Hutter said, "do you think, I mean, is it possible that this is Christmasland? That the person who grabbed your son is aware of what you've been working on, and that there's some kind of connection between your new book and what we saw when we tried to track your son's iPhone?"
Vic stared at the first illustration. It showed Search Engine and little Bonnie clasping each other on a shattered plate of ice somewhere in the Arctic Ocean. Vic remembered drawing a mechanical squid, piloted by Mad Mobius Strip, coming up through the ice beneath them. But this drawing showed dead-eyed children under the ice, reaching up through the cracks with bony white claws. They grinned to show mouths filled with delicate hooked fangs. On another page, Search Engine hunted for a way through a maze of towering candy canes. Vic remembered drawing that, drawing in a sweet, lazy trance, swaying to the black keys. She did not remember drawing the children who hid in corners and side alleys, holding scissors. She did not remember drawing little Bonnie staggering about blind, her hands clapped over her eyes. They're playing scissors for the drifter, she thought randomly. I don't see how, Vic said. No one has seen these pages. Hutter raced her thumb down one edge of the stack of paper and said, It struck me as a bit surprising that you'd be drawing Christmas scenes in the middle of the summer. Try to think. Is there any chance what you've been working on could tie into... Into Charlie Manx's decision to pay me back for sending him to jail? Vic asked. I don't think so. I think it's pretty straightforward. I crossed him, and now it's get-even time. If we're all done, I'd like to lie down. Yes, you must be tired. And who knows? Maybe if you have a chance to rest, something else will come to you. Hutter's tone was calm enough, but Vic thought she heard an insinuation in this last statement, the suggestion that they both understood that Vic had more to tell. Vic didn't know her own house. There were magnetic whiteboards leaning against the couches in her living room. One of them had a map showing the northeast. Another had a timeline written in red marker. Folders crammed full of printouts were stacked on every available surface. Hutter's geek squad was squeezed together on the couch like college students in front of an Xbox. One of them was talking into a Bluetooth earpiece while the others worked on laptops. No one looked at her. She didn't matter. Lou was in the bedroom, in the rocking chair in the corner. She eased the door shut behind her and crept to him through the dark. The curtains were drawn, the room gloomy and airless. His shirt was smeared with black fingerprints. He smelled of the bike and the carriage house, a not unpleasant cologne. There was a sheet of brown paper taped to his chest. His round, heavy face was gray in the dim light, and with that note hanging off him, he looked like a daguerreotype of a dead gunslinger. This is what we do to outlaws. Vic looked at him, at first with concern, then alarm. She was reaching for his chubby forearm to see if she could find his pulse. She was sure he wasn't breathing. When he inhaled suddenly, one nostril whistling. Just asleep. He had dropped off to sleep in his boots. She drew her hand back. She had never seen him look so fatigued or so sick. There was gray in his stubble. It seemed somehow wrong that Lou, who loved comics, and his son, and boobies, and beer, and birthday parties, should ever get old. She squinted at the note, which read, Bike still isn't right. Needs parts that will take weeks to order. Wake me up when you want to talk about it. Reading those four words, Bike still isn't right, was nearly as bad as reading, Wayne found dead. She felt that they were dangerously close to the same thing. Not for the first time in her life, she wished that Lou had never picked her up on his motorcycle that day. Wished that she had slipped and dropped to the bottom of the laundry chute and smothered to death there, sparing her the trouble of dragging her ass through the rest of her sorry life. She would not have lost Wayne to Manx because there would be no Wayne. Choking to death on smoke was easier than feeling what she felt now, a kind of tearing inside that never stopped. She was a bedsheet, being ripped this way and that, and soon enough would be nothing but rags. She sat on the edge of the bed, staring vacantly into the darkness and seeing her own drawings, the pages Tabitha Hutter had shown her from the new search engine. She did not know how anyone could look at such work and suspect her of innocence. All those drowned children, all those drifts of snow, all those candy canes, all that hopelessness. They were going to lock her up soon, and then it would be too late to do anything for Wayne. They were going to lock her up, and she couldn't blame them in the slightest. She suspected Tabitha Hutter of weakness for not putting her in handcuffs already. Her weight creased the mattress. Lou had dumped his money and his cell phone in the center of the quilt, and now they slid toward her, came to rest against her hip. She wished there were someone to call, to tell her what to do, to tell her that everything would be all right. Then it came to her that there was. She took Lou's phone and slipped into the bathroom and shut the door. There was another door at the opposite end of the bathroom that looked into Wayne's bedroom. Vic moved toward this door to close it, then hesitated. He was there. Wayne was there, in his room, under his bed, staring out at her, his face pale and frightened. She felt as if she'd been kicked in the chest by a mule, her heart galumphing hard behind her breastbone, and she looked again, and it was just a stuffed monkey, lying on its side. Its brown eyes were glassy and despairing. She clicked the door to his room shut, then stood with her forehead resting against it, waiting to get her breath back.
With her eyes closed, she could see Maggie's phone number, the Iowa 319 area code, followed by Vic's own birthday, and the letters F-U, F-U. Maggie had paid good money for that number, Vic felt sure, because she knew that Vic would remember it. Maybe she knew that Vic would need to remember it. Maybe she knew that Vic would turn her away when they first met. All kinds of maybes, but only one that Vic cared about. Was her son maybe alive? The phone rang and rang, and Vic thought if it kicked her to voicemail, she would not be able to leave a message, would not be able to force a sound up through her constricting throat. On the fourth ring, when she had decided that Maggie wasn't going to answer, Maggie answered. "V-V-Vic!" Maggie said, before Vic could manage a word. Maggie's caller ID had to be telling her she'd just received a call from Carmody's car, Karma. She couldn't know it was Vic on the line, but she did know, and Vic was not surprised. "I wanted to call as soon as I heard, but I wasn't sure it was a good idea. How are you? It says on the news you were assaulted." "Forget that. I need to know if Wayne is all right. I know you can find out." "I already know. He hasn't been hurt." Vic's legs began trembling, and she had to put a hand on the counter to steady herself. "Vic? V-V-Vic?" She could not answer immediately. It took all her concentration to keep from crying. "Yes," Vic said finally. "I'm here. How much time do I have? How much time does Wayne have? I don't know how that part of it works. I just don't know. What have you told the police? "What I had to. Nothing about you. I did my best to make it sound believable, but I don't think they're buying it." "Vic, please, I want to help. Tell me how I can help." "You just did," Vic said, and hung up. Not dead, and there was still time. She thought it over again, a kind of chant, a song of praise. Not dead, not dead, not dead. She wanted to go back into the bedroom and shake Lou awake and tell him the bike had to run, he had to fix it. But she doubted he'd been sleeping for more than a few hours, and she didn't like his gray pallor. Tugging away at the back of her mind was an awareness that he had not been entirely straight with anyone about what had dropped him in Logan Airport. Maybe she would look at the bike herself. She didn't understand what could be so wrong with it that he couldn't fix it. It had run only yesterday. She stepped out of the bathroom and tossed the phone at the bed. It slid across the bedspread and fell with a clatter and crack to the floor. Lou's shoulders twitched at the sound, and Vic caught her breath, but he didn't wake. She opened the bedroom door and twitched in surprise herself. Tabitha Hutter was on the other side of it. Vic had caught her in the act of raising one fist, about to knock. The two women stared at each other, and Vic thought, something is wrong. Her second thought was, of course, that they had found Wayne, in a ditch somewhere, drained of blood, throat slit ear to ear. But Maggie said he was alive, and Maggie knew, so that wasn't it. It was something else. Vic looked past Hutter, down the hall, and saw Detective Daltrey and a state trooper waiting a few yards back. "Victoria," Tabitha said in a neutral tone, "we need to talk." Vic stepped into the hall and eased the bedroom door shut behind her. "What's up?" "Is there a place we can have a private conversation?" Vic looked again at Daltrey and the uniformed cop. The cop was 6 feet tall and sunburned, and his neck was as thick as his head. Daltrey's arms were crossed, hands stuck under his armpits, his mouth a thin white line. He had a can of something in one big leathery hand. Pepper spray, probably. Vic nodded at the door to Wayne's bedroom. "We won't bother anyone in here." She followed the small woman into the little room that had been Wayne's for only a few weeks before he was taken away. His bedsheets, they had Treasure Island scenes printed on them, were folded back as if waiting for him to slip into them. Vic sat on the edge of the mattress. "Come back," she said to Wayne with all her heart. She wanted to ball his sheets up in her hands and smell them, fill her nose with the scent of her boy. "Come back to me, Wayne." Hutter leaned against the dresser, and her coat fell open to show the Glock under her arm. Vic looked up and saw that the younger woman had on a pair of earrings this afternoon. Gold pentagons with the Superman insignia enameled on them. "Don't let Lou see you in those earrings," Vic said. He might be overcome with an uncontrollable desire to hug you. Geeks are his kryptonite.
You have to come clean with me, Hutter said. Vic bent forward, reached under the bed, found the plush monkey, pulled it out. It had gray fur and gangly arms and wore a leather jacket and a motorcycle helmet. Grease monkey, said the patch on its left breast. Vic had no memory of buying the thing.
About what? She asked, not looking at Hutter. She laid the monkey on the bed, head on the pillow where Wayne belonged.
You haven't been straight with me. Not once. I don't know why. Maybe there are things you're scared to talk about. Possibly there are things you're ashamed to talk about in front of a room full of men. Or it could be you think you're protecting your son in some way. Maybe you're protecting someone else. I don't know what it is. But here's where you tell me.
I haven't lied to you about anything.
Stop fucking with me, Tabitha Hutter said in her quiet, passionless voice. Who is Margaret Lee? What is her relationship to you? How does she know that your son hasn't been hurt?
You're tapping Lou's cell phone? Feeling a little stupid even as she said it.
Of course we are. For all we know, he had a part in this. For all we know, you did. You told Margaret Lee that you tried to make your story believable, but that we weren't buying it.
You're right. I don't buy it. I never did.
Vic wondered if she could throw herself at Tabitha Hutter, slam her back over the dresser, get the Glock away from her. But the smart-aleck bitch probably knew special FBI kung fu, and anyway, what good would it do? What would Vic do then?
Last chance, Vic. I want you to understand. I am going to have to arrest you on suspicion of involvement.
In what? An assault on myself?
We don't know who bruised you up. For all we know, it was your son, trying to fight you off.
So, there it was. Vic was interested to find she felt no surprise at all. But then maybe the real surprise was only that they had not reached this point sooner.
I do not want to believe that you played a role in your son's disappearance. But you know someone who can provide you with information about his well-being. You've withheld facts. Your explanation of events sounds like a textbook paranoid delusion. This is your last opportunity to clear things up, if you can.
Think before you speak. Because after I'm done with you, I'm going to start on Lou. He's been withholding evidence as well, I'm sure of it. No dad spends 10 hours straight trying to fix a motorcycle the day after his son has been kidnapped. I ask him questions he doesn't want to answer. He starts the engine to drown me out. Like a teenager turning up the music so he doesn't have to listen when Mom says it's time to clean his room.
What do you mean? He started the engine? Vic asked. He started the Triumph?
Hutter produced a long, slow, weary exhalation. Her head sank. Her shoulders sagged. There was, finally, something besides professional calm in her face. There was, at last, a look of exhaustion and maybe also defeat.
Okay, Hutter breathed.
Vic, I'm sorry.
I am.
I hoped we could.
Can I ask you something?
Hutter looked at her.
The hammer. You had me look at 50 different hammers. You seem surprised by the one I picked, the one I said Manx used on me. Why?
Vic saw something in Hutter's eyes, the briefest flicker of uncertainty.
It's called a bone mallet, Hutter said. They're used in autopsies.
Was one missing from the morgue in Colorado where they were holding Charlie Manx's body?
Hutter didn't reply to that one, but her tongue darted out and touched her upper lip, glossing it, the closest thing to a nervous gesture Vic had ever seen out of her. In and of itself, that was a kind of answer.
Every word I have told you is true, Vic said. If I have left anything out, then it was only because I knew you wouldn't accept those parts of the story. You would write them off as delusional, and no one would blame you.
We have to go now, Vic. I'll have to handcuff you. If you want, though, we can put a sweater over your lap and you can hide your hands beneath them. No one has to see. You'll sit up front in my car with me. No one will think it's a big deal when we go.
What about Lou?
I'm afraid I can't allow you to speak with him right now. He'll be in a car behind us.
Can't you let him sleep? He isn't well, and he was up for 24 hours straight.
I'm sorry. It's not my job to worry about Lou's well-being. It's my job to worry about your son's well-being. Stand up, please.
She pushed back the right flap of her tweed jacket, and Vic saw she wore handcuffs on her belt. The door to the right of the dresser swung back, and Lou stumbled out of the bathroom, tugging on his fly. His eyes were bloodshot with exhaustion. "I'm awake. What's up? What's the story, Vic?" "Officer," Hutter called as Lou took a step forward. His mass occupied a third of the room, and when he moved into the center of it, he was between Vic and Hutter. Vic came to her feet and stepped around him to the open bathroom door. "I have to go," Vic said. "So go," Lou said, and planted himself between her and Tabitha Hutter. "Officer!" Hutter shouted again. Vic crossed through the bathroom and into her bedroom. She shut the door behind her. There was no lock, so she grabbed the armoire and dragged it squealing across the pine boards to block the bathroom door. She turned the bolt on the door to the hall. Two more steps carried her to the window that looked into the backyard. She pulled the shade, unlocked the window. Men shouted in the hall. She heard Lou raising his voice, his tone indignant. "Dude, what's your beef? Let's all settle the hell down, why don't we?" Lou said. "Officer!" Hutter shouted for a third time, but now she added, "Holster your firearm!" Vic raised the window, put her foot against the screen, and pushed. The whole screen popped out of the frame and flopped into the yard. She followed it, sitting on the windowsill with her legs hanging out, then dropping 5 feet onto the grass. She had on the same cutoff she'd been wearing yesterday, a Bruce Springsteen t-shirt from the Rising Tour, had no helmet, no jacket. She didn't even know if the keys were in the bike or if they were sitting amid Lou's change on the bed. Back in the bedroom, she heard someone crash into a door. "Be cool!" Lou shouted. "Dude, like seriously!" The lake was a flat silver sheet reflecting the sky. It looked like melted chrome. The air was swollen with a sullen, liquid weight. She had the backyard to herself. Two sunburned men in shorts and straw hats were fishing in an aluminum boat about 100 yards offshore. One of them lifted a hand in a wave, as if he found the sight of a woman exiting her house by way of a back window a perfectly common sight. Vic let herself into the carriage house through the side door. The Triumph leaned on its kickstand. The key was in it. The barn-style doors of the carriage house were open, and Vic could see down the driveway to where the media had assembled to record the statement she was never going to make. A small copse of cameras had been planted at the bottom of the drive, pointed toward an array of microphones at the corner of the yard. Bundles of cables snaked back in the direction of the news vans, parked to the left. There was no easy way to turn left and weave through those vans, but the road remained open to the right, heading north. In the carriage house, she could not hear the commotion back in the cottage. The room contained the smothered quiet of a too-hot afternoon in high summer. It was the time of day of naps, stillness, dogs sleeping under porches. It was too hot even for flies. Vic put her leg over the saddle, turned the key to the on position. The headlight flicked to life, a good sign. "Bike still isn't right," she remembered. It wasn't going to start. She knew that. When Tabitha Hutter came into the carriage house, Vic would be frantically jumping up and down on the kickstart, dry-humping the saddle. Hutter already thought Vic was crazy. That pretty picture would confirm her suspicions. She rose up and came down on the starter with all her weight, and the Triumph blammed to life with a roar that blew leaves and grit across the floor and shook the glass in the windows. Vic put it into first and released the clutch, and the Triumph slipped out of the carriage house. As she rolled out into the day, she glanced to the right, had a brief view of the backyard. Tabitha Hutter stood halfway to the carriage house, flushed, a strand of curly hair pasted to her cheek. She had not drawn her gun, and she did not draw it now. She did not even call out, just stood there and watched Vic go. Vic nodded to her, as if they had struck an agreement, and Vic was grateful to Hutter for holding up her end. In another moment, Vic had left her behind. There was 2 feet of space between the edge of the yard and the bristling eyelet of cameras, and Vic aimed herself at it. But as she neared the road, a man stepped into the gap, pointing his camera at her. He held it at waist level, was staring at a monitor that folded out from the side. He kept his gaze on his little view screen, even though it had to be showing him a life-threatening visual. 400 pounds of rolling iron, piloted by a madwoman, coming right down the hill at him. He wasn't going to move, not in time. Vic planted her foot on the brake. It sighed and did nothing.
bike still isn't right. Something flapped against the inside of her left thigh, and she looked down and saw a length of black plastic tubing hanging free. It was the line for the rear brake. It wasn't attached to anything. There was no room to get past the Yahoo with the camera, not without leaving the driveway. She gave the Triumph throttle, banged it into second gear, speeding up. An invisible hand made of hot air pressed back against her chest. It was like accelerating into an open oven. Her front tire went up onto the grass. The rest of the bike followed. The cameraman seemed to hear the Triumph at last, the earth-shaking growl of the engine, and jerked his head up just in time to see her buzz by him, close enough to slap his face. He reared back so rapidly he threw himself off balance, began to topple over. Vic blasted past. Her slipstream spun him like a top, and he fell into the road, helplessly tossing his camera as he went down. It made an expensive-sounding crunch hitting the blacktop. As she came off the lawn and into the road, the back tire tore off the top layer of grass, just exactly the way she used to peel dried Elmer's glue off her palms in third-grade arts and crafts. The Triumph lurched to one side, and she felt she was about to drop it, smashing her leg beneath it. But her right hand remembered what to do, and she gave the bike more throttle still, and the engine thundered, and it popped out of the turn like a cork that has been pushed underwater and released. The rubber found the road, and the Triumph leaped away from the cameras, the microphones, Tabitha Hutter, Lou, her cottage, sanity. The House of Sleep. Wayne could not sleep, and had nothing with which to distract his mind. He wanted to throw up, but his stomach was empty. He wanted out of the car, but could see no way to manage it. He had an idea to pull out one of the wooden drawers and beat it against a window, hoping to smash it. But of course the drawers wouldn't open when he tugged on them. He made a fist and threw all his weight into a tremendous haymaker, hit one of the windows with as much force as he could muster. A shivery, stinging jolt of pain shot up his knuckles and into his wrist. The pain did not deter him. If anything, it made him all the more desperate and reckless. He pulled back his head and drove his skull into the glass. It felt as if someone had set a 3-inch iron railway spike against his brow and pounded it in with Charlie Manx's silver hammer. Wayne was snapped back into blackness. It was as terrible as falling down a long flight of stairs, a sudden stomach-turning plunge into the dark. His vision returned to him momentarily. At least he thought it was momentarily. Maybe it was an hour later. Maybe it was 3 hours. However long it had been, when his sight and thoughts had cleared, he found that his sense of calm had been restored as well. The inside of his head was filled with a reverberating emptiness, as if someone had played a great crashing chord on a piano some minutes ago, and the last echoes of it were only now fading away. A dazed lassitude, not entirely unpleasant, stole over him. He felt no desire to move, to shout, to plan, to cry, to worry about what was next. His tongue gently probed at one of his lower front teeth, which felt loose and tasted of blood. Wayne wondered if he had struck his head so hard he'd managed to partially jar the tooth out of its socket. The roof of his mouth prickled against his tongue, felt abrasive, sandpapery. It didn't concern him much, was just something he noticed. When he did finally move, it was only to stretch an arm out and pluck his moon ornament off the floor. It was as smooth as a shark's tooth, and its shape reminded him a bit of the special wrench his mother had used on the motorcycle, the tappet key. It was a kind of key, he thought. His moon was a key to the gates of Christmasland, and he could not help it. The notion delighted him. There was no such thing as arguing with delight, like seeing a pretty girl with the sunlight in her hair, like pancakes and hot chocolate in front of a crackling fire. Delight was one of the fundamental forces of being, like gravity. A great bronze butterfly crawled on the outside of the window, its furred body as thick as Wayne's finger. It was soothing to watch it clamber about, occasionally waving its wings. If the window was open, even a crack, the butterfly might join him in the back seat, and then he'd have a pet. Wayne stroked his lucky moon, thumb moving back and forth, a simple, thoughtless, basically masturbatory gesture. His mother had her bike, and Mr. Manx had his wraith, but Wayne had a whole moon to himself. He daydreamed about what he'd do with his new pet butterfly.
He liked the idea of teaching it to land on his finger, like a trained falcon. He could see it in his mind, resting on the tip of his index finger, fanning its wings in a slow, peaceful sort of way.
Good old butterfly. Wayne would name it Sunny.
In the distance, a dog barked, soundtrack of an indolent summer day. Wayne picked the loose tooth out of his gums and put it in the pocket of his shorts. He wiped the blood on his shirt. When he went back to rubbing his moon, his fingers spread the blood all over it.
What did butterflies eat, he wondered.
He was pretty sure they dined on pollen.
He wondered what else he could train it to do, if he could teach it to fly through burning hoops or walk across a miniature tightrope.
He saw himself as a street performer, in a top hat, with a funny black stick-on mustache. Captain Bruce Carmody's Bizarre Butterfly Circus! In his mind, he wore his moon ornament like a general's badge, right on his lapel.
He wondered if he could teach the butterfly to do wild loop-de-loops, like an airplane in a stunt show.
The thought crossed his mind that he could rip off a wing, and then it would fly in loop-de-loops for sure. He imagined that a wing would tear off like a piece of sticky paper, a slight resistance at first, then a satisfying little peeling sound. The window rolled itself down an inch, the handle squeaking softly. Wayne did not rise. The butterfly reached the top of the glass, beat its wings once, and sailed in to land on his knee.
"Hey, Sonny," Wayne said.
He reached out to pet it with his finger, and it tried to fly away, which was no fun. Wayne sat up and caught it with one hand. For a while, he tried to teach it to do tricks, but it wasn't long before the butterfly tired out. Wayne set it on the floor and stretched back on the couch to rest, a bit tired himself.
Tired, but feeling all right.
He had milked a couple of good loop-de-loops out of the butterfly before it stopped moving. He shut his eyes. His tongue restlessly probed the prickly roof of his mouth. His gum was still leaking, but that was okay. His own blood tasted good. Even as he dozed, his thumb went on stroking his little moon, the glossy, smooth curve of it. Wayne did not open his eyes again until he heard the garage door rumbling into the ceiling. He sat up with some effort. The pleasant lethargy settled deep into his muscles. Manx slowed as he approached the side of the car. He bent and tilted his head to one side, a querulous, dog-like movement, and stared in through the window at Wayne.
"What happened to the butterfly?" he asked.
Wayne glanced at the floor. The butterfly was in a pile, both wings and all its legs torn off. He frowned, confused.
It had been all right when they'd started playing.
Manx clucked his tongue.
"Well, we have tarried here long enough. We had best be on our way. Do you need to go winky-wee?"
Wayne shook his head. He looked at the butterfly again, with a creeping sense of unease, maybe even shame. He had a memory of tearing off at least one wing, but at the time it had seemed exciting, like peeling the tape off a perfectly wrapped Christmas present.
"You murdered Sonny," Wayne thought.
He unconsciously squeezed his moon ornament in one fist.
"Mutilated it."
He did not want to remember pulling its legs off, picking them off one at a time while it kicked frantically. He scooped Sonny's remains up in one hand. There were little ashtrays set into the doors with walnut lids. Wayne opened one, stuffed the butterfly into it, let it fall shut. There, that was better. The key turned itself in the ignition, the car jolting to life. The radio snapped on. Elvis Presley promised he would be home for Christmas. Manx eased in behind the steering wheel.
"You have snored the day away," he said. "And after all of yesterday's excitement, I am not surprised. I am afraid you slept through lunch. I would have woken you, but I reckon you needed your sleep more."
"I'm not hungry," Wayne said. The sight of Sonny, all torn to pieces, had upset his stomach, and the thought of food, for some reason he had a visual image of sausages sweating grease, nauseated him.
"Well, we will be in Indiana this evening. I hope you have recovered your appetite by then. I used to know a diner on I-80 where you could get a basket of sweet potato fries caked in cinnamon and sugar. There is a one-of-a-kind taste sensation for you. You cannot quit eating until they are all gone and you are licking the paper."
He sighed.
I do like my sweets. Why, it's a miracle my teeth have not rotted out of my head.
He turned and grinned at Wayne over his shoulder, displaying a mouthful of brown mottled fangs pointing this way and that.